Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our culture, our awareness, and how new information is constantly awakening new possibilities. And that is why I'm talking today to former representative from the state of Utah, Merrill Cook. Before we go into that interview, I just want to say today's program is sponsored by Portal to Ascension, portaltoascension.com. Look for the upcoming conference in October with Portal to Ascension. And I'm also doing this program for the upcoming Contact in the Desert. That is June 1st to the 4th at Indian Wells, California. It's going to be an incredible celebration there with tonight's guests as well. So anyway, Merrill, thanks for being on the program.
Well, I'm delighted to be on your program, Alan. It's nice to be out in the New Realities here with you.
Yes, and I have to say, just as a little background as far as how I know who you are, Representative Merrill Cook was one of the six former members of Congress who heard testimony in 2013 at the National Press Club for what was called the Citizens Hearings for UFO Disclosure. Representative Cook was on that panel hearing testimony from these people, and I wanted to get a little background about you as far as your UFO awareness before you came to that panel. And I have to say, I saw in your face a transformation that happened somewhere in the 3 or 4 days in, because I was there in the audience at the National Press Club, and boom, it seemed like you got what was really going on. But before we get there, what was your orientation to the whole idea of UFOs? And actually, Merrill Cook will be speaking at Contact in the Desert, but what did you think about that? And why did you agree to do that panel?
Yes, well, I had a call from the Paradigm Research Group. Stephen Bassett asked me if I might be willing to come to Washington to question witnesses, regarding UFOs. And I had explained to him that I really hadn't thought a whole lot about UFOs. Obviously, just about like everybody's had some thoughts and feelings about it, but I really hadn't put my mind to it much. I explained some of my background, my education, also the committees I served in the Congress on, which included the Science Committee, the Space Committee, the Aviation Committee, a few of those. We'd had very little discussion. In fact, I can't remember on any of the hearings of the Science Committee, and I was a member of two or three of the subcommittees there on science, mm-hmm. including space, that we never had much discussion.
Was that an interest
about that? So it was a new thing to me when I approached the citizen hearing there back.
Was that about four or five years ago? Was science an interest of yours at any point?
Yes, it was. My father was a scientist up at the University of Utah, and my son is a scientist down at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. So yeah. But I also had studied math and physics. Even though my degree was in finance and economics, I'd taken quite a bit of math and science and astronomy and so on. So I was interested in science for sure.
But you got into politics because you wanted to make a difference. I just wanted to get a little...
Yeah, better. That's right. I'm really a businessman who went... to the Congress, I think to bring a bit of a business approach to the art of legislating and to serve the people of the state of Utah there in the Congress of the United States. So.
And how did that go for you being in Congress?
Well, I enjoyed it. I served 2 terms there. It was I was a Republican in a more Democratic district, so it was a very hard district to hold on to. In fact, I was the number one and the number two target of the National Democrats. Both for each of the 2 years I ran for re-election.
Oh, I see. Okay, so getting back
so
to...
I was replaced by a Democrat.
By a Democrat you were replaced by. Okay, we won't
People
talk about...
People think of Utah as a Republican, but I represented the only Democratic district in the state, even though I was Republican.
And even though you were pretty liberal Republican, I have to say, weren't you?
Well, I'd say more of an independent-minded Republican. I took a strong stand on taxes and budgets and fiscal matters, but was more moderate on some of the social issues.
Right. Well, we won't talk about what's going on now in Washington, because that's like a huge conversation.
Yeah.
But, and I'm sure you have some interesting ideas. Maybe when I see you at Contact in the Desert, we can talk about that. But so Stephen Bassett calls you and he offers you some money and says, would you like to be on this panel? And you just say, sure, without, and is that what happened?
Yeah. Yeah, that's essentially what happened. And so I went back and spent the week in Washington there and, we met for 8 or 9, 10 hours a day at the National Press Club there in downtown Washington, D.C., and set up kind of a mock hearing. And we ran that, as you recall, Alan, very much like a typical hearing in the Congress of the United States. We used the 5-minute rule, and we kept pretty much to congressional standards with some obvious flexibility.
So you were one of six people. Did you know the other people in Congress that were on the panel?
Yes,
with you?
I knew each of the others that had I had served with them at the same time. At least we overlapped. I can't remember whether there may have been one that I didn't wasn't in Washington at the same time, but I think the other five, I was, or the other four at least, I was in Washington at the same time. There were six of us, as I recall.
Do you know why Stephen Bassett called you in particular? Were you just available? I mean, how did he find you?
I don't really know. I know one of the persons, Dr. Joe Booklet, you probably know him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Joe apparently, well, it's from Utah, too, knew me. I knew who I was, and apparently had supported me in Congress. I think he's the one that suggested to Steve Bassett that he give me a call.
Okay. So you show up there at this National Press Club with the other members of, former members of Congress for a mock hearing, and did you come with any preset ideas like, oh, this is a joke, or pretty open-minded?
Not really. I had read a few books and a few articles in preparation. Mm-hmm. They had suggested a few books. And after, I have to admit, by the time I came there, after just reading a little bit, I was very interested in what might be said. I felt there might just be something to it. So I definitely approached it with an open mind, but not with any strong feeling either way or any feeling that I knew more than I knew. I knew I was a novice in the area of UFOs, ufology, as it's called, but no, an open mind, I think, would be the best way to explain it. I'm quite fascinated with some of the books I'd read.
Well, do you remember what those books could have been? I'm just curious how you...
Well, I remember one that I thought was quite well put together was, trying to remember her name, Keane, K-E-A-N-E.
King,
K-E-A-N-E.
Oh, Leslie Keane, yes, Leslie Keane. That is a great book.
Leslie Keane, right.
Yes, yes.
And then I'd read accounts of related to Roswell, accounts of Dolan,
Richard Dolan there.
Richard Dolan. So several of the names of people that were witnesses there became familiar to me before I got there.
Well,
not much before. I really hadn't heard of any of them before I had started down a reading list that Joe Bookman and Stephen Bassett had suggested to me.
Well, I do appreciate you, as you know, a former member of Congress, going into that conversation without any prejudices, and just being open. Because I do have to say, what you heard those 5 days, and I've studied this for 20 years, was probably the best testimony from the most studied experts in the field. So you got the best there.
I was highly impressed. I think there were, you probably know more than I do, Alvin, somewhere between 40 and 50, maybe 45 to 55 witnesses.
Right, over 5 days.
And I was impressed with the expertise, the quality, the observations, the articulate abilities. Mm-hmm. Of most of those witnesses, very impressed. It was I guess I could say I got more interested as the hours and the days went by there.
Right. I actually talked to you a little bit outside one of those sessions, and you said, say, how impressed you were. But so the first day, people were just settling, and I would say somewhere in the second, third, maybe fourth day, there was a shift in that whole room. Instead of just what I felt, instead of these people on the panel just showing up and listening, there was a change of consciousness there. Would you say that from your end of it?
Yeah, I think, I don't want to speak for the others, but I think several of them came in without a lot of knowledge, just like me, without a lot of information, and were generally impressed and motivated towards understanding there was definitely something to this, to all these observations and this testimony we were listening to.
I mean, I know that was 5 years ago, 2013, right around this time.
Yeah, it seems like it's a year.
I know. It was in April. And was there a moment where you said to yourself, oh, my God, this is real?
Yeah, I would think, you know, I remember when I started, I mean, I was kind of impressed right out of the chutes. But I guess if there were a turning point where I started thinking, man, this is real. What can I really do? How can I get involved here more than I am to find out more and to really, you know, check this out? And I think Nick Pope, his testimony, it's his observations, over in England, especially the work he did in the Thatcher.
Right, Nick Pope, for
people
don't know,
as a person that worked directly on what they call unidentified aerial phenomena.
Right, for the Ministry of Defense, Nick Pope.
The Ministry
English
of Defense, right.
Yeah.
I think he was particularly impressive to me, and he also the others, along with him, testified about the Rendlesham Forest incident, I think in the early 80s there in near Ipswich, England, near the Royal.
Right.
Or that forest between the two Royal Army.
Yeah, the Rendlesham Forest.
Airport.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And
that really kind of was an eye-opener to me, okay? I had heard of Roswell, and that was very interesting. Learned more about that, but I think the Rendlesham Forest was, to me, one of the highlights of that conference.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that happened in 1980, the Rendlesham Forest, and
right, I think it was around the Christmas time of 19.
Yes, it was. I think it was three nights from December 26th, 27th, 28th. Yeah. And, yeah, the whole American base there at the Bentwaters RAF, Royal Air
right.
Force, did see some very strange objects going down.
Well, yeah, the number of witnesses, the study, the people that came in and took it seriously, and I know they assigned someone from the United States Air Force to, I can't remember the name of the general or the...
Well, there was a guy named Holt, and the guys also testified there in Washington with Sergeant James Pettis.
Oh, yeah, well, Nick Pope, I remember also, but...
Right.
There was somebody that they talked about that was a witness to a lot that was going on at the time. They called him in to the study.
There was a guy named Peter Robbins who came in.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a witness. He was a reporter. And then there was, anyway.
But I'm not talking about, he wasn't there at the hearing.
Oh.
But he was there. He was somebody that the United States government assigned to check out. They're doing a report.
Yeah.
Back in 1981.
Yeah. I'm not sure. But anyway.
But all that history and the testimony about him, even though he wasn't there at the hearing, he's probably deceased by this time, was quite a turning point in my consciousness of the whole field.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah, so that was a turning Nick Pope testimony. Of course, for people who don't know Nick Pope, he worked for the Ministry of Defense in Great Britain, and then he's been living in the U.S. doing lots of UFO conferences talking
right.
about that.
Right, I stayed in touch with him.
You stayed in touch with Nick. Oh, great.
Yes, I think the world of him is...
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's going to be in contact.
Oh, I think he is. He's there every year. He's a brilliant communicator. And
oh, yeah, right.
And very important in bringing a European perspective to this.
Right.
You know what surprised me at the citizen hearings, and I didn't expect it, was the kind of imperial attitude that the U.S. government seems to have to this secret worldwide. I mean, they seem to be the gatekeepers of this information. Did you get that?
Definitely. They seemed, you know, it seemed to me that the entity that probably has more information and had more witnessing of what's happened, at least since World War II, let's say, the entity that probably knows the most or has the most on record, the most observation, the most study, would be the United States government, and yet they seem to be the most guarded and with, well, what I call a fortress mentality, where it's almost like it all needs to stay secret, secret, secret.
But I
don't understand why that is.
Well, but I have to ask you, being a sort of former insider, aren't you the government? I mean, you're a representative. You're working at the United States Congress. You're representing the people. Who is this government we're talking about?
Well, let me tell you, from almost any member of Congress, any senator, to people in the administration, even the various presidents of the United States, I don't think any of them know the answer to that question completely. I think there's a lot of stuff in the Defense Department and when they talk about the deep state these days, I know they're talking more about, well, I don't know who they're talking about, but I think there's sort of a deep state within some of these other endeavors that we're not as familiar with. And one of those is the idea that we classified so much information back in those days. I understand why there had to be some initial concern and secrecy and so on. And, you know, we didn't know but we were observing some of this stuff, like Roswell. To what extent there might have been a communist plot or a communist interference, or a, you know, we barely defeated Hitler at the time. We didn't even know whether he might have some secret, or there might be some remnants of some secret, flying machines, I'll put it that way, or some particular defense or offensive weaponry. But, you know, times have changed. But yet the mentality of keeping everything hush-hush and secret doesn't really seem to have changed. And some of the presidents, from President Reagan to people that have run for president, like Barry Goldwater, like Jimmy Carter, like Bill Clinton, for example, just to name. Right. A few have wondered why some of their questions, especially when they get into major positions of power, cannot be answered or will not, or haven't been answered, I'll put it that way.
Right. Particularly Barry Goldwater was a big investigator of UFOs, and he went to, I forgot which general, and he said it's on a need-to-know basis or something, and was turned away. Do you know that story about Barry Goldwater?
I do. I've heard that. I've definitely heard that.
Right.
I was kind of impressed that in recent months, well, two things have impressed me in recent months, Al, that I want to find out more about. One, Harry Reid and the idea
that I was going to ask you about
he kept some secret fund to study this, or to have this studied by the government, that just barely has come out just this year.
Right.
And then Reid announced from his retirement that he was proud to have done that and felt that he had to keep it secret for a reason. Even though I don't think those reasons were well explained. And then the other thing is of these things that have been observed a couple times now, and even had videos and articles in the New York Times regarding pilots, test pilots, or I think that have had some pretty strange phenomena show up in these films they were able to take from their jets.
Right. For those people listening, what Merrill Cook is talking about is the December 16th and 17th article in the New York Times, 2017, that was December 16, 2017, of the Pentagon releasing video of an unidentified flying object over, I think, San Diego, and then the pilot's testimony, and then this organization that sort of came out about that to the stars, and the article that Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal wrote on the front page of the New York Times about how Harry Reid created a $22 million black budget project to study this unidentified. So did you know Harry Reid at your time in Congress?
Yes, of course, very definitely. Had several meetings with Harry Reid since we shared the same religious affiliation. We would the 13 or 14 Mormons that were there, which included myself and Harry Reid, would meet together every once in a while and talk about things. Plus, you know, so you get to know them besides just as fellow members of the Congress.
Did you call him after this stuff came out? And have you talked to him since?
No, I think you're right. It was in December. No, I'm not. Had a chance to do that, but I was planning on doing that. In fact, I was going to be contacting him on another subject to see if he could help with some a worthy charity fundraiser that they've asked me to contact him with, and when I do that, I'm going to ask him about what he could tell me about this.
Well, if you do, it would be great if he's open to report that conversation back to Contact in the Desert.
Yes, I'll try to do that before June.
That would be really exciting.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, I'm glad you reminded me of that. I'm going to see if I can't get a hold of him.
What I would ask him,
we're friends, actually.
I mean, what I would ask him is, how do we get I guess he's not in Congress anymore, but how would we get a congressional hearing, like instead of being a mock hearing that you guys sat in, a real hearing with maybe some of those same, so we could listen to testimony. Is that possible? Is that something
I think it is. But I can tell you this, not so much the last year or two, but for several years, or a couple of years after that hearing in Washington that I attended, Al and I made a point to talk to my colleagues in the Congress about having some real hearings. And almost everybody says, yes, we should do that, but nobody wanted to be the one to really go out and lead, carry the ball on getting that underway, because I'll be honest, they're still afraid of what I call the poo-poo factor that would come in from the media. They're more interested in the re-election than ever taking a chance on something that could be very meaningful. I found this to be the case. There are only a few that really are willing to go out on a limb, and I haven't. But I've never had anybody say, oh, no, it's an unworthy subject. I haven't ever had anybody say that. It's worthy, but I don't want to be the one to lead it. But I'll certainly join in the effort.
But I do think the New York Times article and the story
might change things, right?
So is there anyone in Congress that you know that would want to lead this, that maybe the citizens or people like Stephen Bassett could approach?
Well, I've talked to Stephen Bassett about that. To tell you the truth, we've juggled various names, but haven't really been able to figure out a current member that we could get to do something. I know Steve has contacted many more people than I have back there. I do have the opportunity that he does not have of a floor privilege, a lifetime floor privilege on the House of Representatives. And even in the Senate, that I'm able to use to talk to people about that. So I do have a chance to, when I go to Washington, I go there once in a while because I'm a volunteer lobbyist for the Alzheimer's Association. And I do have a son that works as an attorney there in Washington. And so when I visit him or the other, I'll try to contact a few people. I've contacted both Republicans and Democrats. And I can really tell you, Al, I'm not just saying this. When I talk to them, I get a sense that they all feel it would be good to do, but they're a little gun shy about being one of the first ones to propose it.
Well, I think there were hearings in the 60s.
That's not where they stopped.
Yeah, exactly.
They hired the Congress and asked the National Science Foundation to study what they had learned thus far in what was known as Operation Blue Book, which I know you understand. I don't know if
right.
your listeners know what that's all about, but there was there was money and time and effort back from the 40s to the early 60s spent by the government on this subject, but because of some negative reports from the National Science Foundation, the United States government basically gave up on studying the issue anymore or carrying out any of the research, even fruitful
Right, and that was probably from those people that the presidents can't even get through who want to keep this. Because of what you said earlier, there was the just finishing World War II. There was this whole sense of, you know, security. And to put this kind of intense information out there may have been too much in the 40s. And then, of course, the secret has just deepened and deepened. But when you said it was meaningful, I think you're really right. I mean, this, but in what way do you think exposing the reality of this, because it seems from all the evidence you heard and you've read and I've heard over 20 years that it's real. What do you think this does to people? How does this affect them emotionally, psychologically?
Oh, well, the effect on the human beings alive today cannot be overstated, mm-hmm. because the effect would be enormous. I mean, we would be answering, quite honestly, some of life's basic questions, wouldn't we? I mean, to understand that there's other life, and of course, you cannot have a UFO experience. There cannot be extraterrestrial UFOs without an intelligence behind it.
Exactly.
It could be artificial intelligence. It could be, but some other, you know, you can't really have artificial intelligence without real biological life intelligence behind that,
right.
at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever that is, I mean, let's face it. We think about it, for people to think it's crazy. Well, we already have what in another sphere could be considered a UFO or, an extraterrestrial from the standpoint of many other planets or even star systems in our galaxy. And it would be at this point an artificially intelligent ship of space, or spaceship, that's permeated the edges of the solar system.
Oh, you mean Voyager.
Sure,
yeah.
That's already outside our solar system. What if somebody
right.
came across that? And there's even information in that if anybody were to, if it were to land somewhere and they were to intercept it, they would have, you know, information that possibly could be understood by a intelligent society. So we already have evidence that if we could do that much right here from our little old Earth and a little old galaxy, a little old part of the little old solar system, imagine what could be, or what the potential is when you consider the vastness of the universe, the chance that other civilizations with intelligence exist. And it must be. I just can't imagine this
like
great
they
universe.
Exist, and
that
they
we're
have,
the only,
right.
that we're the only people that can contemplate the universe or can
it
have
seems
the ability
quite,
to think of
it
things.
Seems quite ridiculous out of 100 billion stars, all of which have planets and possibly life, that we're not an accident of the universe. Life is abundant.
Yeah.
This is my philosophy. But and then if the even in 100 years, look how far we've come with our technology. If
sure.
a civilization was 1,000 or 10,000 or a million years, what kind of technology they would have? But that,
in fact, as you probably know, a famous Nobel Prize winning physics prize winning scientist 50 years ago or so, or maybe more, 67 years ago, said, calculated. They thought about these things even before there was such evidence as Roswell and other things. He calculated that within, I think he said, 50 million years or something like that, which is really a small time given the 15 billion years existence of the universe, that that 50 to 90 billion years, the entire Milky Way galaxy, which is 100,000 light years across, could be colonized
right.
through extraterrestrial space travel. And and so, you know, I mean, it's the likelihood is that it's more likely that there are these civilizations, and it's highly likely that some small percentage of those civilizations have been able to travel in ways that we can only think about now and can't really do. But the technology could be that advanced. And there's another thing I'm going to say here. We don't know all the factors that relate to the universe and exactly how, you know, there's string theory, there's wormhole theory, there's all sorts of things that we don't really, we only have just a novice's glimpse into some of this stuff.
But I think what you brought up just then is the real crux of the problem, because if these ships are coming and there's hundreds of thousands of documentations that they are unidentified aerial phenomena, they're not filling up their gas tank to get here. And there's a technology, right, that will threaten our oil industry.
Well, that's right. So there are a lot of implications for why this might be synced with what Steve Bassett likes to call a truth embargo.
Right.
Which means information that's kept under lock and key and not exposed to the public. But, you know, that's not a reason for stopping progress. Just like the horse and buggy and whip manufacturers may have wanted to keep the automobile from coming forward. But
right. But it's not a reason for us. But look how big that industry is. And, you know, I don't know about the political insight, but do you think politicians are not focusing on this UFO question because of pressure from the oil companies? Is that a possibility?
It is. I don't think that's the main reason, but I think any of those things are possible.
Right.
I just think you stand up on something like this, and it's so easy to get shot down so fast. From all sorts of angles, including that one. So it could have something to do with it. It probably it adds to that, to the reasons why information is being withheld.
What other angles do you think
would stop? I don't think it's certainly not the only factor. I don't even think it may be the main factor.
So the other factor, like you mentioned, is the ridicule factor. No one wants to be, of course,
I think
most
that's
people.
The bigger factor.
But
look,
of course,
what these guys are interested in.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it. No matter whether they're admitted or not, they're interested in the re-election. They're interested in their name being batted about as a strong leader. I mean, let's face it. They all have their egos. Nobody has stronger egos than these political people.
Right. So, what do you think? Is there an answer? Is there a way to move forward? I mean, of course, you're not in, you know, Congress anymore, but you said you, is there a way that this will break open? Does it have to go through the media? If you're looking at the big picture of things, the media, the politics, the business, how do you think this might actually unfold? Like, so the citizens of the world could hear what you heard those 5 days and said, oh, my God. You know.
Well, I do think that what all these groups are doing, including the Contact in the Desert, which I thought was very well run a few years ago when I went, so the one at Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
By having these kinds of meetings, by people continuing to talk to members of the Congress. That's why I think I have a role here. Because there aren't too many people that have been involved as I have. And even though I'm a novice, I have had, you know, experience in Congress, which allows me to know a little more about how it operates and to be impacting Congress more. I mean, not as much as I could if I were elected as a congressman right now. But having been elected before, knowing a lot of people, I think I have a role in this. And that's why I have been invited to several of these areas where disclosure is talked about. Because I think disclosure, I mean, I think if we can unlock those files, that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars of research that we already have, that we should be pouring over in order to best spend the next $100 billion on this.
Well, do you know Robert Bigelow? I mean, he knows Harry Reid and the business. He's put millions of dollars into this technology research.
Yeah.
Are you aware of his work?
Yeah. Well, yes. I've only read the publicity on it. I'm going to get a chance, I hope, to talk to him in the next little while.
That would be great because, when you say you have a role, I mean, I think you're right because you are an insider and you are.
Well, I think I could be instrumental in helping to unlock undo the truth embargo.
How do you see yourself?
Well, one thing I did was these two airmen that had been injured, probably with some heart injury. For the experience at Rendlesham Forest.
Oh, that's John Burroughs and James Pendison in 1980.
Yeah, I've stayed in touch with them because I had actually sent letters in right after those hearings back in 2013 to the veterans and to the Obama administration to open up those files. And I found out just last year or so that some of them did get opened up. And I think that's an indication. You open those files, all of a sudden you see, well, there really must be something to this because the medical personnel in the Air Force knew about it, wrote about it back then. That's just, you know, you take, in other words, sometimes you have to take a truth embargo down brick by brick. You know what I mean?
Right.
You got to go
right.
Slow and eventually it collapses. Eventually things open up. But, you know, the way we determine a lot that we know, think about it, as Americans, as people anywhere in the world know, you establish truth and information and the best possible facts through witnesses. And that's about all we have, but to cover up what we know, what witnesses have seen, is dead wrong. There should be no excuse for that. Not in America, not in any free society.
Well, I think that's a great strategy. I mean, yeah, if we could do that, if we can get some people that you know on the inside, or even you, I think we have a chance to... Well, shake up the planet and get it back on course for why we're really here to enjoy creation, you know?
I definitely believe that, Alex.
So at Contact in the Desert, what will you be speaking about?
I've been asked to perform a few seminars. I know that my subject will be disclosure. Mm-hmm. Disclosure. Where we're at, what we need to do, why we need a 1,000-fold increase in the amount of disclosure that's already happened. That'll be my subject area mostly.
Would you say, I mean, since 2013, did your life take a turn? Did your interest, I mean, something, your eyes open?
Oh, yeah, I definitely got interested. I've been on a number of radio programs. I'm grateful to have a chance to be on your program here. And I've attended some of these conferences. I attended the one in Tucson. I've attended whatever I've been invited or whatever I've been able to. I've been invited to or wasn't able to go to. But
right, I mean, I appreciate you being out there and being so honest and open, but...
Yeah, Steve had said openly in public, he said, well, Merrill is one of the five or six, maybe one other, that has really followed through and tried to continue to do a little bit of work in this area.
Well, James Gravel was there last year, the senator.
Yes,
who was
Gravel was there.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and he put some of his own political ideas out there. But I think, you know, really, like I said before, I could see you were, in a way, the most passionate person on that panel saying, yeah.
Well, I really did take it seriously. A few people, even the New York Times, said that to me. So I appreciate your saying that, Al. The New York Times has been in touch with me a few times, mentioned that about me, that I seemed to be one that was really, I'll put it this way, getting a kick out of it. Okay? In other words, being really energized and excited by it.
Yeah, moved by it. Moved by the possibility, because I think
moved
you're right.
Moved by it. Interested to find more.
Yeah.
And I do plan on spending, now that I'm more retired than even I was then from my business, I'm going to make it a point to spend more time on this.
Well, but I think you see the bigger possibility. It's not just, oh, there's things in our sky. It changes everything for who we are as human beings on this little planet. I think you see that.
Well, that's right. This is a highly interesting field of endeavor. Plus, I've really enjoyed meeting the various people I've met in this quest to learn more.
Hmm. So when you talk about disclosure, you're working with Stephen Bassett to bring people together? I mean,
Well, I think the main thing we want to do is find out what really is known, not just by the United States government, but by any government anywhere or any group anywhere. I don't think any country is withholding their files like the United States is. But I just don't understand that, why we would be the leader in disclosure. But we're not in this field. We are not the leaders in disclosure. Mm-hmm. And yet we have more information. Maybe it's because we have the most information. But that's not an excuse.
No. So, but something seems, I think the New York Times articles, I think the, what do you think of the Tom DeLonge To the Stars movement with Louise Alexandro?
Yeah, I think that's, again, all these things are going to help us break open the files and learn more. Mm. I think all this is good.
Mm. But it seems like there's, because even when the New York Times did it, it was a very short news cycle. It's like, I don't know, of course, there's a lot more political stuff happening. And so there has to be a way to wake people up saying this changes everything more than local politics or national politics.
Yeah.
This is a game changer.
This is one of the most significant stories ever to be told on Earth in its history.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm glad you're out there doing what you're doing. I'm happy you're coming to these conferences. Do you remember at the end of the conference, James Gravel said something like, what's his name, James? Whatever. Gravel said, there's more conspiracies than you know, but not as many as you think. Do you remember when he said that?
I do. That's probably true.
What did he mean by that?
I'm not exactly sure, but conspiracies do happen. And they're, again, a lot of it has to do with ego, a lot of it has to do with pride of ownership, a lot of it has to do with fear. A lot of it has to do with just status quo is the natural inclination of human beings. But I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but it's probably true that there's more than we know, but obscure than we think sometimes.
Mm.
I don't know exactly what that means, but I get his point.
Should we do like, I mean, you're in Utah, right? Should we do like a citizens conference there for the staff, or are the people you know, are they interested in the subject?
Well, we do have a MUFON organization. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard of MUFON.
Yeah,
Mutual UFO Network. But when they've tried to get major events going, they've fallen short a little bit. I can contact some of those people and see what might be done here. It'd be nice to do something right here in Utah, too.
I mean, but are the people you know, like this, the regular people, are they open to this?
I think they are. I think they're open. I've been on the radio several times. And, you know, I've been ridiculed at times by the news media here.
Oh, you have? Yes. Oh.
A lot of people love it when I talk about it.
Right.
And I can just say this, some of the reporters may have ridiculed me, but the people listening don't. I get lots of calls and even notes and telephone letters and even emails from people that say they loved what I was trying to say and being involved in this. So I think people are open everywhere about this. I don't think it's a problem of the American people not being interested. I think it's a problem of we've been too inundated or too controlled by, you know, what we used to call the main street press that didn't always open up to the truth. And Trump has other words.
Right.
For it. I'm not sure Trump is exactly right on everything.
No.
He says
no,
about that, but I do think there's a lot of media bias.
There's media bias.
Against, and, yeah, I know. This industry.
I don't know if he's right about anything, but he does say there is a media bias, because you know, even the liberal paper, even things like Democracy Now, which is very liberal radio television, they don't even touch the UFO subject.
Right. I know there's a lot of doubt.
That's surprising for me, because so on both sides we get this a negation in the news about the possibilities, but then you're saying, and I believe it, that people want to know.
Absolutely.
And so I would support any movement you propose to get the word out. I mean, I'm glad you're coming to Contact in the Desert, and I think that's important. And, you know, maybe when we meet there at Contact in the Desert, we can see what kind of brainstorming we could do to get a series of talks happening in different parts of the country.
Well, I look forward to discussing that with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think going to different parts of the country and saying, look, let's just have the truth about this. This, you know, I think there has been a turn in the media.
Absolutely.
I mean, the New York Times did shift the way they reported stuff like that.
Right.
So, and if you might want to ask Harry Reid if he wants to go out too publicly and talk about this subject.
Oh, yeah, I will. I'll talk. I'll give him a call. I can't even see if I can see when I'm down in the Las Vegas area next time.
Yeah, you might want to talk to Robert Bigelow and see his warehouse, you know?
Yeah.
Then that's one question I did want to ask you, because supposedly the $22 million that Harry Reid got, as the New York Times said, was given to Robert Bigelow to test some of the metals he got from these crashed UFOs. And supposedly he had to build a whole warehouse section, maybe they were radioactive, whatever, but if he's developing technology from that, doesn't that belong to the American people?
Of course.
So he can't really legally or without giving back to the American people whatever technology he develops from these reverse engineered metal samples.
Well, I think that's right.
I would be curious what Harry Reid says about that. And
sure, I'll find out what he can tell me.
Yeah, you can always call me, too.
Sure,
you can do
I've got your number and everything.
Oh, follow up on that, because don't you think that's a little suspicious? I mean, the suspicion, and, you know, I know it's inside, but they said also that when they put this $22 million out there, they took different bids, and...
Yeah.
I mean, it seems suspicious that, you know, it seems like Harry Reid's best friend, Robert Bigelow, got the bid. I mean, maybe... I mean, what are other...
Yeah,
I know it's what happened, but it's just part of that whole...
Well, I'm just glad they're doing something. We're studying.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make this a little better based, but I'm glad that something is being worked on.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your time. You have anything else you would like to say about the subject?
Well, no, it's just that I do appreciate your interest in this. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your program. I look forward to talking to you. And I can tell you, disclosure is something that not only am I interested in, but I think based on my background, based on my experience, and based on the fact that I've been served in the Congress of the United States, I have a special responsibility to try to do a little more here and to see if I can't add to the canon of knowledge regarding the sources of these UFOs. I mean, the UFOs exist. The only question is, to what extent can we show and have proof that it's an extraterrestrial source? I can't figure out what the other source could be. I think extraterrestrial is the only possibility, but that's what we need to really find out a little tighter than we have so far.
Right, and if it is extraterrestrial, then what is the ramifications of, you know?
Yeah, there's significant ramifications in this.
Well, on all levels, socially, politically, even...
Absolutely.
Religiously, spiritually, you know.
Of course.
But I think that's the place, I think people like Leslie Keene and Tom DeLonge, they want to start, okay, there's something out there. This unidentified aerial phenomena. Let's establish that. I think that's the strategy. And then
I think that has been established.
It's been established.
There's something
there.
We just don't quite understand the source of it yet.
Right. And also, if there's something there, who's controlling that? That's the obvious question.
But to deny that there's something there is to deny the reality. Even the Project Blue Book proves that there's unidentified flying objects that our best sources of information and intelligence could not figure out. That's why they're unidentified.
Exactly. And then people like J. Allen Hynek, who worked for Blige Project Blue Book to disprove it, was eventually converted and said, wait, I'm not debunking the truth. I mean, he had a total turnaround from debunking to accepting the fact that there was something out there.
Right.
Do you know his story, J. Allen Hynek?
Well, I can't quite recall right now. I've heard the name.
Oh, he's the guy who labeled the close encounters of the first kind, second kind, third kind. And he worked as an astronomer for Project Blue Book to disprove these cases. And he had this famous line that said it was swamp gas at this... place in Michigan, I think it was, and then he realized that, why is he making these things up? This stuff is real. He had a total turnaround, and he became a huge advocate. A Center for UFO Research, this is where Jacques Vallée came out of that study. A lot of people in the field now came from J. Allen Hynek's kind of turn around on the subject. He even talked in front of the UN about the subject. So
I see. I don't know.
Well, there's so many factors and characters, and we're part of it, Merrill.
Right.
So, thank you. If people want to reach you, do you have a website, or do you have
Well, let me just give you my email address for anybody. I'd always be interested in communicating with anybody. The easiest way would be shoot me an email and we can figure out a way to talk over things. But that's Cook, COOK, 506 at MSN.com.
MSN.com.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. So you're still in Utah, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Like in Salt Lake, around there?
In Salt Lake City, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. I haven't been there. And then we look forward to seeing you at Contact in the Desert.
You bet. I'll look forward to that. Well, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yeah, no, I'm happy because you in a way transcend political party. You're someone who stands up for the truth and with integrity. That's what
that's what I care about. I never was very partisan, actually.
Yeah,
that's one reason I was able to win in a Republican in a Democratic district. But
too bad everyone in politics isn't like that, right?
Well, yeah, there ought to be more cooperation. There was more cooperation when I was there than there is today, it looked like to me.
I think we're just passing through like a wave of transformation in politics right now.
Right.
I think it's when we come out the other side, we'll be a healthier political country.
I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you, and I'll see you at Contact.
For sure.
Right.
And I'll be in touch with you if I hear any more. Same time, you will.
Yeah, if you want to give me
information on some of the things we've talked about here.
Yeah, no doubt. If you want to give me an update on the Harry Reid or just.
I will, for sure.
And I'd love to even do an interview with Harry Reid.
Yeah, we'll see what will be done.
I know George Knapp is out there doing interviews with these people.
Oh, yeah.
If Harry Reid wants to come to Contact, I'm sure he's invited as well.
Oh, yeah. I'll mention it.
Invite him. I'm sure it would be okay with the organizers.
Yeah, he's not too far away from where it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I'd have to check with the organizers, but I'm sure they'd be very, very open to the fact.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That this is the guy who gave.
With what, we learned about him last December, right?
Right, who got $22 million to study UFOs. Yeah. No, that's exciting.
Okay
thank you, Harold. Okay, talk to you soon.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Okay. That was Merrill Cook, former representative of Utah to the U.S. Congress, who was on the panel for UFO disclosure, Citizens for UFO Disclosure, in 2013 at the National Press Club. And like I said, he had a huge awakening. I mean, he came in pretty open-minded, but then, like, oh my God, this stuff is real. And now is still on the subject. 5 years later, he'll be speaking at Contact in the Desert. That's June 1st to the 4th at Indian Wells in California. That's outside of Palm Springs. You can go to contactinthedesert.com. Get tickets along with a lot of other amazing people, really the top of the UFO field. I'll be there hosting and speaking. Whitley Strieber, Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolan, Grant Cameron, Stephen Bassett, really major names in this sort of field that have been at this for years trying to get at the truth, and we're getting closer to the truth. My name's Alan Steinfeld, and you can reach me at newrealities@earthlink.net, and you can go to my new website, New Realities Events. I'm hosting Linda Moulton Howe in New York in May. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back.